Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is educator, writer, and author Ira Raboy. Raboy is a graduate of both SUNY Binghamton and the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. He started his teaching career by joining the Peace Corps in 1969 and teaching English in Sierra Leone. He has since taught at the Clearwater School in Trumansburg and for over 25 years at the Lehman Alternative School. He is just completing a book about his teaching ideas called Mindful Questioning, Teaching Critical Thinking with Mindfulness, Empathy, and Emotional Literacy. And welcome to the show.
No, thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you started out on your academic career earning a degree in philosophy, I read. Mm-hmm. So was that where you were going to head? And how did you segue into teaching?
Yeah, well, that's complicated. It was, of course, when I was in college, at least undergraduate, it was during the Vietnamese War. So I had to think of what I wanted to do. And, well, making a long story short, I wound up teaching in the Peace Corps. And before I started teaching, I was thinking, you know, like, how do you make your life really valuable?
Yeah.
You know, when, you know, there's a time of a lot of demonstrations and political actions and
a lot of anger, too.
A lot of anger and fear, too, you know. Mm-hmm. But I could never imagine a normal life.
Yeah.
I mean, I could never imagine, like, I was in Michigan, I got into philosophy, but philosophy was a pre-law program. So I was trying to figure out what to do, and I couldn't imagine being a lawyer.
Yeah,
and I couldn't imagine being in an office. And I, you know, with all the things going on in the world, I had to do something that would make a difference. That would not only make a difference, but feel meaningful to myself and feel
full. Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah,
and I didn't think teaching would do it, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because you know I had some really great teachers when I was younger, and especially in college. But I didn't think teaching would make it because normal public schools were just not very exciting.
I know. And it was conformist.
Yeah,
and there wasn't that much innovation going on. That's why I think it's really interesting that you, in your career, you have tended to lean toward nonconformist schools, alternative schools,
right.
Clearwater,
and
Lehman.
And the piece, well, the thing is, it's like I try to be an artist or a writer. And, you know, and then I realized while doing that, that why I wanted to be an artist was to inspire people or to change people or to educate people.
Mm-hmm.
So then I said, well, and then especially with the experience in the Peace Corps when this turned out to be true, why not go directly to teaching?
So that's how I Well, I wish more people felt that way about teaching because it is a creative career, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just reading a book and having kids repeat back what you say, right?
Well,
I mean, that's the worst of education.
Yeah, right. A good teacher never does that. I guess I was blessed. I work with a lot of really good teachers, but they would never do that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to internalize what you're teaching.
Yeah, and you have to believe it.
Yeah, and you have to do it in a way. You have to internalize it enough so that students believe you.
Yeah.
Not just the lessons that you're teaching, but you as a person.
Yeah.
You have to be real.
Yeah.
A good teacher is always sincere, not only in what they say, but who they are.
Yeah, so. I understand. I've had some good teachers, and I remember the bad ones, too. Now, let's talk about this book that you're just finishing up. It's called Mindful Questioning, Teaching Critical Thinking with Mindfulness, Empathy, and Emotional Literacy. Tell us a little bit about what all this means.
Well, in fact, I was just working with some teachers yesterday on, you know, teaching with questions. You know, how to engage students? How do you deal with students who are so disengaged that they won't even go to the classroom or they won't do the work? You know, how do you get them? And other people say, you know, critical thinking is really difficult. You know, and we got a lot of examples of really poor critical thinking in the world. So what do you do? And what I'm trying to do in the book is trying to get people to understand that if you understand yourself, and how your mind works, and you put attention into the quality of the moment and the quality of your mind, then you can work out these other things, and you can learn better. You can, like, reading a book, well, you know this, right? Mm-hmm. When you read a book, did you ever have the feeling like you read it and then you understood nothing? Or are you even saying a word? We think that words are automatically meaningful, but to have a word be meaningful to you and to the person you're speaking to, because it's a mutual thing. Like, you and I together have to be meaningful together.
So are you trying to get people to not just sit there and let the moment go by, but to dissect it?
Well, I want to get into it is more like it. It's engage with it. It's to feel your life in the book, right? So you get your focus, your attention, and learn how to focus attention. That's why mindfulness is important. So you use mindfulness to get yourself focused. You use mindfulness and emotional literacy to sort of engage and develop your emotions, because without emotional interest, there's no contact. There's no meaning.
But how do you get a 15-year-old kid who's going, this doesn't mean anything, let me just repeat back what the teacher says and he'll give me an A,
Well, because...
how do you get a 15-year-old to even think about mindfulness?
Well, first of all, you got to start right away. Like how you enter the classroom, not only in the beginning of the school year, but each day. You got to enter the classroom with that engagement yourself. So first, like I said, you have to be sincere yourself. You can't go in there and tell a student to engage when they know that you're not engaged, right? And then you got to bring the student in various ways. Like I always like to start each day with a question. Actually, later in my year, we started each day with a mindfulness practice. So right away, students, they come in and they do the mindfulness practice. And on the one hand, they can let go of everything else.
Okay. So you focus them.
You focus their
mind on a question instead of thinking about what am I going to have for lunch and when's the bell going to ring.
But the thing is you're not just focusing them on the question, because a question is also words and something. You have to be able to engage with that. So the question by itself is good, but you can go further. And you can go further by getting the student engaged with the moment that they're alive, to feel themselves, because usually they say this doesn't have any meaning because they feel already separate from their lives, right? Isn't that why people feel that?
Oh, I assume so, yeah.
Yeah.
But you say you base this on some of the new studies about neuroscience and brain studies and stuff. So tell us a little bit more about how you get a kid into this.
Well, I mean, we all remember our schooling, right?
And many moments of it, yeah.
And we walk in, and how do you feel? You say, oh, no, not this again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So what do you do? So one of the things that's happening in your brain is your emotional centers of your brain, like your amygdala, are interpreting the situation in the classroom either from fear. And it usually is a little bit of fear, fear of not getting a good grade, fear of, because, teenagers especially, but most of us spend a lot of our time thinking about how we look to other people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right? And also in school there was a lot of boredom, frankly.
But it's boredom because that experience is never recognized. If you recognize a student's moment-to-moment experience, then they come alive in it. The boredom and the disengagement and the fear come from pushing you away. Like you asked about why I became a teacher. You become a teacher, or I became a teacher anyway, because I didn't want my life lived that way in disengagement. I wanted a life and a mind. I wanted my mind and my emotions to be real, to be engaged. So mindfulness, so you start the day with a practice that gets you right there. Yeah. And right there, if you practice it, the weird thing is that you don't know exactly what's going to happen.
So it's exciting, right?
Yeah.
It makes it exciting. So some of this is akin to getting people to think about meditation, right? Or to get into meditation, focusing the mind.
Right. Well, mindfulness is actually a form of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of the, mindfulness is used a lot nowadays. But mindfulness, technically and traditionally, is a form of meditation.
Mm-hmm. And so you could do this at the Lehman Alternative School, and you're presenting this in a book. Don't you think there are a lot of schools would say this is mumbo jumbo, and it, you know what I mean? It's going to be interesting to see how you talk people into seeing that this can work.
Well, I'm not alone, actually. I mean, there's a lot of different universities, there's organizations all through the country, actually all through the world, are teaching mindfulness in schools nowadays. And there's a lot of research showing everything from a 14% increase in students after only an 8-week program, scoring better on tests. And tests, I think, are ridiculously awful. But what mindfulness does is it helps you learn how to clear your mind, focus your attention, and keep yourself, it's sort of like when you're driving, right? You got to look out and you constantly you know, make
alert.
Sure that
yeah.
that you're on track, that you're staying in the right place, mm-hmm. and there's no deer running in front of you.
Yeah.
Which
no,
we
you
have
do.
A
you
lot.
Have to stay alert, and you have to stay right in the moment.
Right.
And if you don't, of course, we know what the consequences are.
Right.
And you know, I understand what you're saying because I have to do that in my life. Every week, I have to focus my mind on a new guest, new That's, ideas,
yeah, yeah.
new books. And it's hard to do sometimes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I was thinking, one of my friends, a fellow teacher, teaches ecology.
Ah.
And, you know, mindfulness, in a way, is ecology.
I can understand that, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, ecology is basically how everything evolves together. And changes and adapts together. It's not just, you know, like some people when they study evolution, they think about humans adapting to their environment. But it's not that. It's like everything forming together.
Yeah.
So when you're mindful, your mind is working naturally and ecologically. Because what's happening is your mind is engaging, attuning with the environment, and also attuning, so it's attuning externally and, although this is somewhat artificial, internally to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both together. So the mind is becoming ecological. It's actually becoming the world around it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so then you can see why it's so important for a student to learn this. Because then, no matter what the situation or what problem you give the student, they can engage.
They'll have
it.
The tools to engage, yeah. yeah. I think they should probably learn that from day one so that they can proceed with their education in a more mindful way, right?
And get along with people better.
Exactly, exactly. I know. Know thyself. Now, you were teaching when all this standardized testing started and, you know, taking over the educational systems, especially in this country. Talk to us about what you think about that. You know, has it ruined education? Has it stopped creativity?
It hasn't stopped it. I mean, teachers are marvelous people. There's so many wonderful teachers. You know, to listen to the news, you would think that public schools are, you know, have a lot of really awful teachers. And mm-hmm. as far as my experience is concerned, that's not true.
Yeah. But what is testing doing?
Well, the thing is, it's
so
like we
time.
Talked about meeting.
Uh-huh.
Let's say you're taking a test and you're a student. What do? Well, you worry about your grade. And so you turn your whole education, which should be, if it's taught well and naturally, an exciting thing, the excitement is like smashed. And the mind is reconfigured to deal with fear. And once you reconfigure your mind and you're dealing with fear and looking at education with fear, your learning process has stumbling blocks in
it. Yeah, yeah.
Because when you're afraid, your mind doesn't work very well. It only picks up the messages that have to do with fear.
Yeah, and so that does stifle creativity, individuality.
Right.
And it does it to the teacher, too. It's like a prison, right?
Yeah, yeah. Years ago, I was on sabbatic, you know, I think it was 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing research on all this stuff. And there's more research now, and I don't know all of it. But back then, there was no research whatsoever to justify not only standardized testing, but high stakes, any kind of test like that.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the claims that high stakes testing increases learning, even assesses it, were inaccurate. In fact, the research that I found, some of it was from this guy, David Perkins at Harvard, that schools that did not do any standardized testing, and you took those students and compared how they did at Harvard and afterwards, and I don't know if they did it other places too. It's been so long, I don't remember mm-hmm. the exact things of the experiment.
But those students did
but
better, right?
Those students did much better in terms of being creative and, you know, like applying what they learned to the environment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ira Raboy. We're talking about a book that he's just finishing up and hoping to get published soon called Mindful Questioning, Teaching Critical Thinking with Mindfulness, Empathy, and Emotional Literacy. Let's talk more about testing. I read an article by Diane Ravitch in the New York Review of Books a couple months ago, and she was talking about how the envy of the Asian schools because they get such high scores is misguided because a lot of those kids are almost robotic. They've lost their creativity. creativity. They're not individuals or treated that way. So let's elaborate on that idea that testing is stifling people's personalities in many ways.
Right. Like I was saying before, the fear. And also the fear of the teacher. It's both, because the teacher now, we're like in New York State, you know, is evaluating teachers partially based on test scores.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, even talking about, well, we'll get rid of the worst teachers. So that turns the whole teaching profession into exercise of fear and censorship, right? And so it's saying, teachers, you have to do this or you're going to lose your job. That's not a way to make a teacher creative. Like, let's say you're a teacher and you have, like, some of my classrooms, I would have students who would be on the third grade reading level and students who would already be taking classes at Cornell.
Ah, yeah.
Now, how do you deal with that amount of differentiation in a classroom? You know, if you have to deal with a test, of course, the kids who are already on the way to Cornell, they're going to do well anyway.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
to try to teach, to meet all those needs, a teacher has to not only know each of those people, but you have to be able to create. You have to feel like you can take chances. Now, when you have fear, you don't have the time, you don't have the mental clarity to take those chances and to meet the needs of your students.
Yeah. And those standardized tests are unfair, too.
They're unfair.
In regard to kids from different
and they're
cultures
artificial.
And different lifestyles,
right,
and parental involvement or not.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, just recently, they were turning out, what are they called? Cut scores, I think they're called. You know, they cut scores are the score, basically, at what level we're going to say a student passes. If I remember how they use the term correctly.
Yeah, right.
Because,
right,
you know, I've been out for 2 years, so I'm losing some of the latest.
So
a cut score, let's say a cut score in New York might be one thing, and in Pennsylvania, it's a different one.
Yeah.
So where's the objectivity of these tests?
Yeah.
Not only do you find that the kids who are tested decrease in their creativity, but right now, they're being predicted that 30-40% of the students will pass them. Now, how can you create tests so that you know that 50-60%, 70% of the kids are going to fail?
Oh, and you're setting up kids for failure life, because this will be a traumatic experience.
So, and
so
what's
does your
the
book
justification
talk about
for
this?
This?
No, there isn't. I mean, people are still trying to find that. But is your book going to be addressing that? What are we going to do about this? It's taken over the country like a virus.
Well, it depends on what you look at it, whether it's indirectly or directly. I don't talk a lot about statistics because they're like Diane Ravitch and other people are doing books like that. What I want to do is something unique. What I want to do is take the reader inside a classroom. And, you know, you read that public schools don't teach students how to think clearly, mm-hmm, that public schools don't prepare kids for work. Mm-hmm. Well, let them come in the classroom and see. That's what I want to do. I want to bring the reader right inside the classroom so they can see how you use questioning, you use the students, well, not use the students, you allow the students' lives to come into the classroom in a meaningful way.
And you also do these, like, acting out stuff. Don't you do little scenarios where people can take parts? And
well, sometimes. Like, one of the demonstrations for a book, you know, instead of being a test, they actually had to act out the characters.
That makes sense.
Right. And, you know, so we read Ordinary People. So the students acted out the people in the novel in a family therapy session.
Yeah,
and there was a family therapist as the leading the session. So I try to do things like that. But also with mentally, you picture, visualize, like you're dealing with a character. So you're reading Damien.
Ah.
And you're trying to understand this very complex book. So you have students actually visualize being and imagining the emotions, motivation, imagery of this character.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to bring it so that there's this internal questioning is being met by internal empathy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, and so then you can totally have a more depth of understanding, not like the superficial understanding which tests create, but the in-depth understanding, real true-to-life understanding that you get from actually engaging inquiring into the subject matter.
Oh, yeah. It sounds very enriching to a kid.
Right.
To be able to do something like that. Now, do you address the reality of there's a lot of poverty, there are kids who are malnourished, there are kids whose parents are not engaged, and they blame teachers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're constantly saying teachers should be able to compensate for this. What are some of your solutions? In all your years of teaching, how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, sometimes parents blame teachers. You know, teachers can be blamed
for anything. Well, politicians certainly have
been. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah,
politicians even more so. Like, teachers can't correct economic system.
Yeah.
There are too many inequalities, and it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The way to engage that is to be human and allow the students to be human. So you can't pretend that everything is wonderful in the social economic system when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You can't engage students who are running into racism or sexism or something like that in their lives.
And bullying, that's a huge topic.
You can't ignore that. So what do you do? Well, some classes I did this thing where I had students work on their own essential question. So I call them personal essential questions.
Mm.
So what they did was... in one class, I started the year by saying, what are the problems of our world? And I did it different ways, but what are the problems of our world? And the students would make a list. And I said, okay, if you have all these problems, well, which are the basic ones?
Mm-hmm.
And then go to the basic one. Which is the most basic one for you?
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, that's your final. To find
so
out
have to write
the
an
answer
essay.
To that question.
Ah.
And they can answer it in different ways. They had different ways they could answer it. Like some of them would do PowerPoints. Some of them would do presentations of other kinds. Some of them would do an essay. But the idea was you had to use the course material and you had to do some of your own research. But I wanted them to mostly use the course material so they would really engage with the course. I wanted you to say, use this course material to answer your question.
Yeah.
Why is there sexism? Why is there racism? How does it arise? What are the factors that give rise to it? Or, you know, like environmental stuff, you know, and what are the correlates? You know, like students came up with all kinds of things.
So they were coming up with solutions. They were already working in the world in some way.
That's right. And sometimes solutions, but, you know, to understand the solution, you have to see the different diverse areas and connections and interconnections of things to understand how to create a solution. You can't solve anything from a limited perspective. You got to take as big a perspective as you can.
Yeah, let's see. That we go back to the problem. Teachers
That's right.
are now spending most of their time teaching to the test.
Right, and that's
and
that's,
so the creativity is not there. The mentorship sounds like you were quite a mentor, you know, facilitating these kinds of discussions.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
But you know, it's amazing to see what students can do when they're challenged in a meaningful and supportive way.
Yeah, yeah. And when they have a teacher who seems to be engaged and care.
Yeah, right.
And really want to hear from them.
Right. And, you know, you got to appreciate your kids. your students, I should say.
Yeah. I know you have studied Zen meditation throughout, you know, many years. How has that affected you as a teacher? It must have informed much of your thinking.
I can't separate it. You know, it's become me.
Yeah.
And one thing, you know, a lot of the teachers, Zen teachers and other meditation teachers and Buddhist teachers, some of them are just amazing people. They're inspiring in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. You know, I was talking about that I wanted to be engaged. I wanted to live a full life. And those teachers, like my karate teacher, for example.
I wanted to bring up karate as well. You practice karate, too.
Yeah.
And you teach it.
Yeah. So I teach the meditation. So my karate teacher, Heidi Ochai, was extremely focused individual.
Uh-huh.
And he became this model of also compassion. But compassion, you know, like compassion is not just being nice.
Yeah, nice, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes compassion, you got to be tough.
Exactly. Tough love. I mean, we've heard all those terms.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I like the term tough love. But it's like, you remember we talked about that the mindful mind is ecological. It's basically not separate from its environment. And so that's what compassion is. Like my teacher said, when you are compassionate for someone or towards someone or act in a compassionate way, your actions are coming from you being this other person. And, you know, so sometimes when I didn't know how to teach a student or meet their needs or understand why they were, you know, acting in a certain way or not being able to, so I would meditate, and then they wouldn't be separate. They, of course, they are separate.
So the compassion would come in, and
that's
the empathy.
Right. And so then I'd be able to feel, not only intellectually but emotionally, is this coming from fear?
Yeah.
Is this coming from this? Is this coming from that? Is this coming from not understanding? And then I'd walk in the next day and I'd have an answer.
You'd be able to engage.
And not that the meditation would give me an answer.
Yeah.
You see, what it
does... Just taking the time did, right?
Well, taking the time and you see the person differently.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Right.
That makes sense to me to be able to put yourself in that place. And instead of... You know, so many people do engage with kids who are acting up and stuff with anger.
Right.
And that's probably the worst thing that you can do.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, that's part of the thing of thinking critically, going back to that. Like, we don't understand the full mental process of critical thinking. I don't either.
Yeah.
But what I've realized, especially like working on the book, you know, and trying to get it done and edit it and do all these things that are not as much fun as the initial joy of just putting things out, right? So what you got to do is you got to work with your mind. And critical thinking, you got to work with your mind. So like in creative theory, they have this thing about incubation, you know, walking away or sleeping on the problem, you know. So one thing you got to do in critical thinking, one part of the process is this mindfulness of what's going on with you so you can step back. It's not just mindfulness so it directs you where to go. It's also mindfulness to tell you when to stop and take a breath.
That's really good advice. Ira, we are almost out of time. Real quick, can you tell us what you hope to have happen when this book gets published?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm an idealist. I mean, I would love for it to make a difference, that people can see that our public schools and our teachers are doing the best they can, that the situation, we really want to change it. We have to, one, you can use the stuff that I use, you know, mindfulness, meditation, teaching critical thinking, teaching through questioning, engagement, and loving, and
compassion,
your profession, and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But also recognize that our whole society has to shift.
Yeah, one person at a time, though, one person at a time.
Right.
Can you give some contact information in case people want to get in touch?
Well, I have a website. It's just myname.com, Ira, IraRabois.com. And then you can see the blogs, and when the book gets published,
it's a great website. Ira's website, because there's all kinds of material, information, philosophy, everything on it. Ira Rabois, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book, soon to be published, we hope, is called Mindful Questioning, Teaching Critical Thinking with Mindfulness, Empathy, and Emotional Literacy. Thank you, Ira.
And thank you so much, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.